Welcome back to the continuing versions of scenarios created based on stupid things Jeff Van West did and managed to tell the tale, because I once was a flight instructor flying a 152 from Renton to Boeing Field and got rolled past 90 degrees, only 400 feet above the ground. But Dave, you and I share this, that we got rolled at Boeing Field. You described it happening in a Cirrus. And you jumped on the controls. I want to ask, how much of your success surviving that encounter was based on the fact that you had instincts honed from aerobatic experience? And how much was just, it's your instinct to try and roll against the wake vortex? Or to put it another way, if any average pilot was rolled close to the ground, how likely are they to survive without aerobatic training like you had?
You know, I think the other pilot would have done okay. You know, they would have flown out of this. It just would have taken longer. And I could feel the indecision in the pilot when this happened. But it's like, because of all the upset training and the unusual attitude training and just, you know, nature, it's so deep in the alligator brain to just fix this. And the primary control input that helps, it's forward stick, you know, don't stall, and top rudder. And I think that the top rudder is the easy part to overlook. And it's probably the part that helps the most.
To be clear, for people who aren't familiar with that term, when you say top rudder, what does that mean?
Well, it's if you just picture the airplane at a 90 degree bank angle, you know, the traditional elevator isn't, you know, we use the elevator to raise the nose. The elevator can't do that at a 90 degree angle. So the only control surface at the pilot's disposal to keep the nose from falling is the rudder. And in this case, right or top rudder. The term top rudder is just, you know, when you're in aerobatic flying, it's just easier to conceptualize top and bottom than left and right. So it's like at knife edge or 90 degrees, top rudder is the, you know, the step on the sky. You would hit that rudder.
Okay. One more moment with you, Dave. You said that that's when you're rolled 90 degrees. If you were only rolled 60 degrees or something like that, is that still the rudder I want?
Right. I would say beyond, you know, anything beyond a steep turn, you know, that it's, if it's steeper than 45 degrees of bank, then top rudder is going to help, you know, just it's, and once it goes past 60, it's just a lot easier to think of it in terms of top and bottom.
And everyone here at the table is in full agreement with you, except the one person who probably has just as much aerobatic experience and the math to back it up. But Catherine, you're a 3/4. And might I remind you that Dave referred to 4 as, I believe it was, quote, pure Hollywood fantasy.
All right, sure, I'll bite. So first of all, I am in full agreement with Dave in terms of pushing and trying to right the airplane using your right aileron and your right rudder. Anything you can do to keep this airplane from going upside down is what you want to do. I will say that any roll in a Cessna 152 is a dirty roll, you know, even if the flaps are up. You know, you're not going to get out of this situation with a bunch of power like you would in an airplane that's more optimized for aerobatics. So I'm in full agreement with Dave, except that if you don't have a choice, if despite all of your efforts to make the airplane roll back to the right, if those are unsuccessful, then you have no choice but to join the roll and continue it to upright. That's not a great situation because during that roll, you want to be as coordinated as possible to help minimize any altitude loss. And I'll tell you, doing a coordinated roll in a Cessna 152, so I have a 152 aerobat, I've got a lot of rolls in there, and it's really, really tough to do that in a way where you're minimizing your altitude loss. So what I tell my students is, you know, try to keep the airplane upright, but if you can't beat the roll, then join it. And, you know, you're just going to have to push while you're upside down. And then when you're right side up again, You're going to convert to a bit of a pull to try to keep the airplane, you know, away from the ground. So I'm in agreement with Dave, but there might be a point where you don't have a choice. And keeping the yoke forward is going to help you during that roll.
So let me stay with you, Catherine, before going to David. There are two things you said in there that I feel the need to follow up on. One was you talked about if you did have to go with the roll, they're very difficult not to have altitude loss. We only have 400 feet in this right. situation. Is it better to descend into the ground fighting the roll, but descending at a known rate, versus trying to go with it and potentially nosing completely down and spending that 400 feet essentially diving into the ground because you rolled with it and the nose went right over and down?
Yeah, at 400 feet, you could probably, let's just say that you have not been able to arrest the roll despite all of the, you know, the pushing forward, the power, the, you know, opposite aileron, the opposite rudder, and you just cannot stop that roll. You're going to go upside down regardless. You know, 400 feet, it can be done. Honestly, you know, if people haven't tried it, they could possibly lose it at least that much. But you are going to have the greatest probability of success if you continue to push forward and at least minimize that altitude loss. The worst thing you could possibly do is pull back on that yoke.
Got it. Let's go to David, and then we'll go to Paul. David.
I think the problem with trying to roll through is you'd need so much forward stick. The engine would likely cut out as you went through the inverted. You know, if you want to sort of get to an extremis, nothing left to do, at 50 feet, I'd snap roll it, half snap at level. I think they, you know, keep riding it down. And if you're still, you know, knife edge, getting close to the ground, I just stick a great big yank backwards. The airplane actually snap rolls quite quickly. And then at least that way you're going to hit with the dirty side down. But I think personally, and I used to teach on a 150, and I just don't see this maneuver being done, you know, without being premeditated. Like, you know, if you were set up for it, you had it in your mind and you were an experienced aerobatic pilot, yeah, you can make it work. In this scenario, I just don't see rolling through. What's likely to happen is the airplane's going to hit the ground upside down and kill everybody.
And I think nobody is advocating that being the rolling through as being a good idea, right? So definitely it would be, as Catherine was saying, it would have to be a last ditch if it was even possible. Paul.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems incomprehensible to me that you could pull off going with the roll unless you had practiced that specific scenario related to a wake turbulence upset. And you had gone through it and you had established some kind of training structure to instantly analyze and understand what's going on and had actually planned it. Because the thing is, as Catherine said and David said, when you start going with the roll, you really have to get the stick forward right now, because mm-hmm. this roll is going to happen. You're going to be inverted in, what, a second. So you really have to have started the forward stick ahead of that. And it just seems difficult for me to believe that you could do that unless you had specifically trained on that exact scenario. And the other point that I think everyone has made and Dave made is that understanding the benefits of unloading the wing rapidly, really, I don't think it emphasized much in flight training, because there are not too many scenarios that are either novel or emergency where loading the wing would be the right thing to do. But there are a lot where unloading it buys you both time, adds energy, adds airspeed, and gives you some options. And that's another thing we probably should think about practicing, about what that means and how to do it and when to do it. And this is a classic example. It's just a Pavlovian response, get rid of the load on the wing, and you've bought yourself stall margin and you've bought yourself some time to fly out of it. And I'm not sure, you know, the top rudder is important, but if you only did the unloading of the wing, I still think you'd probably be all right. You'd probably the nose would fall through more, but you could probably recover it.
Now, Catherine, I was noticing a lot of nods in there about the unloading of the wing, and I know you've talked about this. We should really expand this a little bit into training that, you know, you've done a great deal of upset recovery training for people, and there are going to be plenty of people who are never going to go through that training. So I'll ask you this, having a sense of your answer, like if somebody remembers only one thing about an upset and nothing else, because as Dave said, down to reptile brain, what is the one thing that you've got to remember?
Right. Yeah. That word is push. Yeah. And, you know, this is a universal first ingredient for really virtually all upset situations. I was fortunate enough a few years ago to be invited by UPS to do their upset training in their 7-6 simulator. And their procedure for any upset situation, the acronym that UPS uses for their upset situations is PRPS. And that first P is to push, because they recognize that all what Dave was talking about, all of the virtues that you have when you push forward, you are unloading the wing, you get your roll stability back, you get your speed stability back. There's just such goodness in pushing forward on the yoke. I want to comment on a couple of things that David said. First of all, the engine is not going to quit on this. The only time I can get the engine to quit in my 152 is if I'm actually going below zero Gs. So when I try to maintain inverted flight with negative one G, it takes about 2 to 3 seconds or so for my engine to quit. If you're going to zero G, which is probably what you would be doing if you are going upside down to continue the roll, the engine isn't going to quit during that maneuver. And again, just to reiterate, I am only advocating continuing the roll if you have absolutely no choice. Another thing about the snap roll, I think that would be the worst situation because, of course, to induce a snap roll, you're pulling back on the yoke and you're losing any control of the airplane that you have. You know, I've snap rolled my airplane many times, and it's just it's a really sloppy maneuver in a Cessna 152.
I'm not sure I agree with you because of the way this scenario is going to develop. But the one thing, though, I think that everyone's raised, and I think the point that really does need to get emphasized is that automatic response to push. And that's, I think, one area where, as was pointed out, flight training doesn't do a very good job. And I think because if instructors haven't been exposed to any aerobatic training, they won't know it, and therefore the students won't. And so I've certainly put that in my training, and I think as everyone else does, but that's not common. And so if that doesn't happen, then this pilot is done, I would suggest.
I'd like to get back to upset training, but obviously our emphasis in our training environment is on avoidance. So that goes back to what would any of you have done differently in this situation, if anything? I mean, did this pilot really do anything wrong? You know, they were aware of the jet. They knew that the winds were blowing the winds away from the jet. There was a helicopter. They had it in sight. The helicopter was doing an air taxi towards the ramp. John.
First of all, I got to say, in this situation, I would probably die. Because unless you've had a lot of aerobatic experience and training, it's such a counterintuitive maneuver. When you're in trouble down low, you know, you would first thing would be to add power. But the second thing most people would do would be to pull back because, you know, you want to make the houses get smaller. So I can't overemphasize, and you guys can talk about the training. But your question, Jeff, was about the avoidance. And this is really a situation when you're on your own. You know, your VFR, air traffic points out the traffic to follow. There's not even anything in the 7110 that talks about helicopter wake turbulence, or there's a whole bunch of phraseology for controlling helicopters on the ground, but really nothing for the wake turbulence. And I think most controllers have no clue really what a large helicopter can do to a light aircraft. And in this scenario, you notice that they were more concerned with the Gulfstream departing on the parallel runway than the helicopter that you're about to follow. So it really puts it back on us. And I think going forward, it's going to be really interesting when we start seeing all these eVTOLs buzzing around low altitude in these areas. I mean, who knows what kind of weight they're going to be throwing out with multi-rotor systems and whether they're carrying freight or whatever. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about that with essentially these giant quadcopters, you know, not only that flying through each other's wake, because the,
yeah,
what we found was this, study on wake vortices from helicopters is an older FAA study, but it was shocking how they behaved actually differently than the wake we're all taught about. And I was never taught about that. JP.
Yeah, I do a lot of primary flight training, and I would say that this element is really missing from the curriculum. If you follow the FAA curriculum, we do some unusual attitudes and that sort of thing. But in this scenario described here, I would venture to guess that the majority of private pilots at this altitude in this situation would not survive because of the instinct to pull back. The last thing they're thinking about is pushing forward and doing the right thing. That's why I always encourage any private pilot, go out and get some aerobatic training or upset training. And they may come back and say, aerobatic training, I don't want to, you know, do loops and rolls. I want to fly straight and level. And then I go a bit further and say, well, what if you get in a situation, whether it's weather or wake turbulence, where you're not straight and level and you need to have that skill set kind of ingrained to help you get out of this?
Catherine.
Yeah, I have two comments. First of all, if you've seen a video on that's been on YouTube for several years now, it's a Black Hawk that approaches, lands at an airport. And I think it takes about a full 45-ish seconds, somewhere close to a minute. And then you see a Cirrus, like an SR-20 or SR-22 coming in for landing. And you see this, the Cirrus gets rolled and ends up crashing. Fortunately, the pilot actually walks away from it. So that's the good news about that video, is that it actually had a good ending. But it's sobering. You know, you can see how much time elapsed, and yet the uncommanded role that the Cirrus pilot, sustained is very serious. Second comment is about the FAA's guidance, which I think is really misguidance. The FAA's guidance on wake turbulence has the pilot trying to imagine where these vortices are. But of course, you know, it's insidious because you can't see them and you're only guessing as to what the effects of the winds might be and such. So the only way to truly know you're going to avoid something like this is to put enough time between operations. So this pilot should have been concerned not only by the Gulf Stream, but also by the helicopter operation there. And you know what I tell people is, let a couple of minutes lapse between operations. And if the winds are particularly calm, make it at least 3 minutes between operations. So I think the FAA should really be advocating just wait, you know, provide the time between operations. And that's the key to avoidance.
And that can be a real challenge at a place like Boeing Field. When I was instructing out of there, waiting 3 minutes between operations would mean waiting until like sometime after midnight, because it was just so busy. But, you know, that's the way it goes. Dave.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's excellent advice by Catherine, because I remember being in the right seat of an airplane. We're getting ready to take off from a busy airport. A big Navy helicopter goes by, and the controller says, you know, cleared for takeoff, caution, wake turbulence. Fortunately for me, the left seat pilot in the airplane I was in said, you know, I think I'm just going to pass on that takeoff clearance for now and sit here for a while. And then I just thought, wow, what a great example. That was some really good head work and some really good discipline.
Paul,
listening to what we're saying about training, there's a certain fantasy here that goes on that we kind of perpetuate by saying, okay, you're going to get this upset training. But that training's perishable. It's not a one-time thing. So I think so that if it's going to be effective, you need to repeat it. Just having seen it once is probably not going to ingrain the basic instinct that you need in a situation like this, where you have you basically have 1 second to respond, or maybe a little bit less. So you need to repeat that training, which really argues for the to emphasize what training resources you have and what training time you have towards avoidance.
I do want to get back into training a little bit here, but David, you had something to say.
I was just going to say and to follow on with Paul. So I was the examiner for a flight instructor rating flight test, and we were on downwind. There was a Dash 8 on final at our home airport, and the instruction was to us, the instructor who wanted to be flying, was that he was asked to plan to exit at Taxiway Golf, which is the first taxiway, which is about 1,400 feet down the runway. And so there was no way that could be done without flying through the wake of the Dash 8. And the instructor was all ready to do it. He was, you know, quite a low time. He just had just enough hours to meet the minimum requirements and was all set to turn base and make it happen. And I took control and said, you know, enable, and we went around. But I think speaking to the avoidance piece, a busy airport, low time pilots, as long as the instructor, or sorry, as long as the controller says caution, wake, turbulence, he's done his job. And so that event really caused me to emphasize more the importance of not getting talked into something that you don't want to do, which can happen at busy airports, especially when there's a mix of large airplanes and small ones. So I think that's a message that you have to, instructors need to put in their students, and people flying now have to be prepared to say unable when they are given an instruction that potentially would result in a wake turbulence encounter.
Yeah, and to John's point earlier, a lot of the official FAA guidance is really skewed towards bigger equipment, you know, moving around other bigger equipment, and not necessarily something with incredibly light wing loading and, you know, 2,000 pounds of gross weight at that. Dave?
Yeah, when I was, I don't know whether they're still marketed this way, but when I was, you know, early in my flying, the unusual attitude aerobatic training was billed as, you know, this is your sort of kryptonite. You can, I mean, you can, once you do this, it's your, you wear this gold star and you're impenetrable, you know, you're invincible. And the example they gave was this low altitude wake encounter where you roll through and just go ahead and land on the fixed distance markers like you were planning. You know, I mean, it's just nothing imperturbable, nothing's going to get to you. And for me, the epiphany of my own little wake encounter at Boeing Field was that didn't even occur to me. You know, the instinct to right the airplane is just so incredibly strong that I'm just focused on that. And, you know, I know that pushing on the stick and adding top rudder are the best ways to do that. But I'm curious about your own wake encounter. You had a low altitude wake encounter at Boeing Field. I'd love to hear about that.
Well, yeah, the moderator usually doesn't jump in with the own stories here. But I think one of the takeaways is clearly don't land at Boeing Field. It's very dangerous. It's really one of the things that you need to understand. No, I had a student who got stranded due to rain at Renton and called me and got a ride in a car just like that. And I had to bring the plane back the next day and thought it was going to be pretty cool to do this incredibly short flight. I tried to make it 0.1 if I could possibly do it. It was exactly this set, except it wasn't a helicopter. The wake was off of a departing DC-8 cargo plane. So it was a very heavy DC-8 coming out of Boeing Field. I watched where it rotated. I knew the wind was going to blow its vortices over towards that runway, but it used so much runway at Boeing Field. By the time it rotated, I was like, okay, great. I'm going to be landing well before where its wake even begins. And on the approach, 400 feet in the air, the 152 rolled. And I would say the 90 degree point, not because it looked that way, because it kind of looked like it was upside down, but I remember to this day the feeling of the seatbelt on my hip holding me in place from the wake. I was in that position long enough to be pressed into the seatbelt on that side. And at the time, I had been doing aerobatic instruction in our 152 aerobat, and with all full controls and top rudder, only because I was trying to roll in the right direction, it just sat there bobbing back and forth. I might have pushed, but then it popped out. But the interesting thing that happened after that, as I cleaned up and started to go around, was I hit the other wake because they were both blown across the path. But that one I was ready for and sat there bobbing at about a 60-degree bank until I popped out of that one. But that brings up another point here, which is if you do manage to survive this, you powered up and like you're getting away from that ground, is there a best next move? Do you try to climb up and away from this, or do you fly forward and try and get some more airspeed for some more control? Catherine, you teach upset recovery after the upset. If you get control again, what is someone supposed to do if they manage to survive this?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, if you manage to get out of this, it doesn't mean that you're out for good, right? You just mentioned that you hit one and then a second one. You know, who's to say that there isn't some other disturbed air up ahead of you? So I would certainly keep a higher airspeed. You know, I would climb away, but I would do it more at a cruise climb, and just to make sure that I have better control authority as I'm coming around to hopefully a more empty airport.
So, you know, David, you mentioned about CFIs, and this sort of also speaks to training as we're gotten back into that role. Do you think an instructor would have a better chance of surviving this than an average pilot? I survived my little encounter, but I'm not a good example because I was once a week doing spins and rolls and things with private students who wanted it. But your average run-of-the-mill CFI, did they have an edge at all? And if not, you know, where do you go to get the right kind of training from the right kind of people? Not everyone can be on Catherine's schedule.
I think the fact that you had done some aerobatics was pretty critical in you not panicking, because I think the problem is if you haven't seen those steep attitudes, if you haven't experienced, you know, the initial disorientation, then that's the killer, right? Because you're going to see a picture that you've never seen before. You're going to have to apply control inputs full that you've never probably done before. And you have to do them in the right order right away. And so I think sadly, I think most pilots would not survive this. Those that had aerobatic instruction would. And as a story, the worst thing that happened to me in training was an upset in a multi-engine instruction ride where we were doing the engine cut on the overshoot. And so we were up at 4,000 feet. The airplane's climbing away. As you know, I call go around, the student goes to full power, and I pull one of the throttles back. And I have no understanding what happened, but his first reaction was to pull the stick all the way back. And so the airplane stalled with one engine full blast and gear and flaps down. And it basically snapped to inverted and started the entry to an inverted spin. And so I took over upside down, nose dropping through maybe 45 degrees down line, and the airplane starting to yaw violently. And then, so yanked the power back, and I found out that the gear retracts really fast when you're upside down, and then cleaned it up and recovered. And I really think if I had not had aerobatic experience, that they would have been game over at that point. And the thing was, we went from in control to violently out of control so quickly, which is, I think, the scenario here, and that's really the killer. So if you don't have that muscle memory, if you don't have that instinctive reaction like Dave had with the Cirrus, then it's not going to end well. And so upset training, I think, really is important. And it's interesting to note that EASA now requires the commercial pilot license training to include a mandatory upset training module. And really, that's where we should go in North America, I think.
Before we close this up, I want to follow up on one thing you said, Paul, because I would like to hear from some of the people doing regular upset training or aerobatic instruction in general about this, or even people who've been through it, which is the perishability factor. So all skills are perishable to some degree, but if you know that you can only get upset training once and you may never be able to make time for it again, is that false confidence that you're better prepared for something, or is even just some little exposure worth the potentially substantial time and expense of trying to make this happen? Catherine.
So certainly the skills are perishable, but having that experience is certainly valuable. Obviously, the more that you can do recurrent training, the better. You know, the airlines do that every couple of years for upset training because it's that important to have that on a continual basis. What I think of a hallmark of good upset training is it takes people over the edge so they know what the edge looks like, but it also has the pilot walking away not overly confident. There's a humility, I think, that good instruction instills. So I think if somebody is walking away overconfident, I would question the quality of the training they received.
When this all happened to me, obviously I'm no Dave Hirschman, but I was doing some basic unusual attitude recovery stuff at the time in the 152. So I had the edge, and that might be why I'm still here. And it seems to me the real takeaway is, even if you can only get it once, get that edge. You might not be able to keep it sharp, but it would at least give you some sense of what this kind of situation is and some fighting chance of remembering to push and then working your way out.